Roth Radio, DLR in the house. My very special guest, Kevin Wilmot. He's the director and the writer of the brand new film, Confederate States of America on IFC. Kevin, welcome one more time.
Hey, thanks, dude.
Okay, we were talking a little bit about what this movie actually is, and I've been thinking that you've kind of bridged the gap between traditional documentary and reality. Okay, reality is not real. The reality series that we see, somebody getting voted off the island, or
exactly.
or house rules, road rules, or my favorite, Flava Flav.
Yes.
No, maybe that's real.
Yeah, maybe that is real.
that is his reality, and that's Bobby Brown. I was going to say reality. The jury's still out.
The jury's still out. We'll see, right, how it all turns out.
I think, again, what you've depicted is something so close to real. The way that it comes off of the screen is that you will fool people, okay? Was that your intention from the beginning, or did you start the work and it sort of found its way?
No, that was always the intent because, the CSA was real. It was a real government. It was a real nation, and they had a real constitution, and they had a cabinet and a president. And so I wanted people to just fall into the world of the CSA so that they would kind of get an experience of living through what this could have been like, And so it being real was really, really important to us.
And you're talking about the Confederate States of America here. You're also a professor.
Yes.
Okay. How does this work in terms of how you find the time to work film and also instruct?
Well, they were really hip. When they hired me, I was already a filmmaker. So they kind of hired me to kind of keep doing my shtick a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And so they've been really good about, wanting me to continue making films. And of course, Kansas is out in the middle of nowhere. But we have really a burgeoning kind of film scene that's happening out there. A lot of great independent filmmakers are kind of growing up out there right now.
What about the film music? What was your choices there?
Well, I wanted to, again, we kind of satire of the Ken Burns style, so I wanted that kind of thing to be behind it. And one of the things we satire in the film is that there is no rock and roll in America. Rock and roll comes out of Canada in the film, because all the slaves get to Canada, and so, Elvis is, of course, arrested and because he's imitating black artists, and so, he has to go to Canada to become the king.
Well, but at one point in time, that was the reality. Okay.
That's exactly right. And that's, again, another example of, I had an actual clip that talked about, Elvis and race music and how he needed to be banned and stopped and so forth, and that clip was in such bad shape I ended up reshooting it on my own. But so, again, everything in the film is based in some kind of reality, some kind of truth.
Yeah, that same reality still continues to this day. People are still whining about the lyrical content and that something's too black or too Hispanic, too Latino or whatever, and that it's going to ruin the Mormon nation or whatever voter bloc that is.
Yeah.
Just for laughs, I brought in a Playboy magazine from 1972, and I didn't tell anybody during the entire show. Every subject that I brought up, I just picked it right out of the magazine, and everybody thought I was being as current as Paris Hilton. I just left the names out. Oh, seriously.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's the thing. As more things change, the more they stay the same, And in fact, some ways, maybe we're going back the other way a little bit. So, that's really the challenge is, guys like us that grew up in the 70s, I mean, we are, we saw when people were kind of wanting to get real with things. And when you've had that experience of those 70s movies and that 70s music and all that hip stuff that came out of that era, it's hard to kind of, sit around and see people be so dishonest anymore.
Okay, blaxploitation pictures. Do you accept the term?
Oh, totally.
Okay. I loved those pictures. Full of lead and he still ain't dead. My life is based on that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I
am looking like Dolomite to get my own all-girl Kung Fu army.
No doubt about it.
Oh, you bet.
No doubt about it.
But those got discontinued. Why?
Well, I think it was a good and bad. What happened was, people, some of those movies were kind of poorly made and had the same movie over and over again. But there were some great films that came out of that era, too. And I think we threw the baby out with the bathwater, and you see that same kind of movie being being made today. You know, it's like when you go to the video store, you see all these B videos, and it's always the same plot of some, you know, rap artist is his boss is ripping him off, and he's got to get a gun and do the whole bit. And so, you know, it's not like it's something new. You know, I think, you know, when you look at those films like Superfly and Shaft, I mean, Burt Reynolds was making those same movies too, White Lightning, and you know, all those kind of things that were like white exploitation at the same time. So for me, I hope to make a film.
Yeah, but you know what? Now that we're talking about it, they didn't have the music. Burt never had the soundtrack.
He didn't have the soundtrack.
I can sing to Sasha, who's 21. Now, honey, you tell me what song this is. Talking about. You dumb white lady.
Sorry. I'm a dumb white girl.
That's Shaft, baby.
No, really. Every time I walk into a cool club on a weekend, in my mind is going,
There you go.
You got to get your own soundtrack. I'm saying it funny, but I mean it serious. Every one of those pictures, whether it was James Brown, Black Caesar, Give Me a Dime in New York City, you know, and on, those songs remain. They're being sampled over and over again. They symbolize a whole era. And the whitesploitation never had that.
Never had it. They never had, and I think that, you know, when one of the things that's great about those old films is that they were designed not for everyone. They were designed really for black people. And one of the reasons why, you know, people have kind of bought into those today is a lot of folks didn't get to see those movies back in the 70s. Now that they're on video, it's like, wow, what is this all about? And so it's like this whole other universe that a lot of folks didn't get to see. And so it's, you know, those films influenced me a great deal growing up. And it really made me believe I could be a filmmaker.
I went to, I was in the integrational busing program, started in the mid-60s. I went to schools that were 95% black and Spanish speaking.
Yeah.
Even to this day, John Muir High School out in Pasadena, etc. Wow. I still drive a 51 Mercury lowrider. Oh, yeah. And we knew that those pictures, those movies were not available over on the other side of town where the Van Halens were from in Pasadena High School.
Right.
That was all white.
That's
and
right.
We would go to the Washington Cinema. It was called Cinema 21.
Yeah.
And there would be, there was the Swantech gang. So there'd be roughly 9 white people.
Right.
And everybody else was black and Spanish speaking. And that was 2/3 of the experience.
Oh, exactly.
Okay. We had, in my troubled childhood, we had special jackets that we got from Salvation Army, twice as big as normal, so that you could put your bottle in the back of your pants and sneak it in.
Yeah.
And everybody would yell and scream and cue the movie. Look
That's
out.
Right.
Something's coming. You know, and like this.
Yeah.
That was 2/3 of the experience. Is that gone permanently?
Well, you know, when you get to go to a film in the hood now, you still get to experience that a little bit, but I don't think it's the same because of what you described. I mean, part of it was the film itself. The film was speaking directly to that audience, you know, in a way that movies today don't do that nearly as much as they used to. And so, you know, part of that call and response that you've got going with the audience, you know, was because those movies were designed for them, you know. And so they did things in those movies that you just don't see anymore today. And they say things in those movies, political things. They didn't care because it was only for a very small group of folks.
Interesting thoughts here. I'm talking to Kevin Wilmot. He's the director and the writer of The Confederate States of America. What movie made you want to go into movie making, Kevin?
Well, you know, one of the big ones was Shaft, because Gordon Parks is from Kansas. You know, he's from Fort Scott, Kansas. And so I grew up, you know, with Shaft and Superfly and all those movies. And, you know, when you're out there in Kansas, you know, you need somebody that you can relate to. And Gordon Parks was that for me.
I know Gordon Parks from his still photography work, okay, which is more difficult, still photography or making a movie?
You know, probably still photography, to be as great as he is, because, you know, you're capturing a moment, you've got to get it the right look, and it's so difficult to capture that right essence of that exact second. And so probably I would say still photography.
Spike Lee, very controversial figure. What part is he playing in your picture?
Well, Spike saw the film when we went to Sundance and really loved the film and just wanted to support us. And so it's a Spike Lee presentation. So, you know, he's been really great by just lending his name to the film and trying to give us a little cred and a little bit of boost.
And when you go to, you went to Sundance, correct?
Yes.
How do you get the attention? attention. How do you get your in a world of sore thumbs?
Right.
How do you stick up? How do you stick out?
Well, you know, we were very fortunate that the movie kind of worked on its own for us. You know, that the fact that, you know, when people asked the question, what would happen if the South had won the Civil War? Bang! All of a sudden, folks, and then Spike being attached helped a lot. So we were able to generate a buzz just from the movie itself.
Interesting stuff. You fan of country music?
You know, some country music, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, my wife likes it more than I do, but you know, but there's a little bit I like.
But even that is now becoming dominated by the black culture. I don't care if you're wearing a bandana under your straw cowboy hat, okay? I don't care. You're gang signing off the tour bus.
Yeah.
You follow every... It looks exactly like hip-hop video if you turn off the sound. Now, there is a marked similarity there. Kevin Wilmot, he's the director of the Confederate States of America. What do you got cooking up in the future? What are we going to look forward to coming from you, Kevin?
Well, you know, we were talking about blaxploitation. I have a story I want to talk about, you know, tell about the blaxploitation time. We're going to see those movies in the theater in my hometown, a little small town in Kansas. And as well, I have a movie about, it's called Gotta Give It Up, which is about what happens when, it's a modern day version of Lysistrata, when women go on a sex strike to end gang violence, and then they end up ending the war in Iraq as well. So, you know,
this sounds like trauma films here a little bit, but I'm with you.
Yeah, and
I want the T-shirt.
You want the T-shirt? That's what you want. You want the T-shirt? Then I have a big film we're working on, which is about Will Chamberlain when he was at the University of Kansas and played basketball there, and he's kind of the first black superstar, really basketball superstar, and broke his 1955, and so he broke a lot of barriers coming in there, and it's a great story.
You got your work cut out for you, Kevin Wilmot. Thank you so much for joining us here this afternoon.
Thank you, David.
God bless.
Clev Dave Ayokosa. ここでは私たちが雨を降らせるの。Rough Radio. First thing in the morning. Dave TV. Nothing but yeah.
Roth Radio, D-Row in charge. Be Young in the back there. Be Young in front. Play it. Oh. Live in the studio. I went and I did the coolest thing this last week here. You know, I'm a licensed helicopter pilot. And I took Animal up. I took Be Young up, about 4 weeks ago or so? Did you guys have a good time?
Oh, yeah.
That's not your first time in a helicopter.
That was my first time in a helicopter.
Oh, well, how did I do? I guess you're walking, talking.
Exactly.
Was that your first time in a helicopter there, Animal?
No, it was my second. My first time is like when me and Easy went up to see Guns N' Roses up in San Diego. They took us up in a helicopter. It was pretty cool.
What, you and Easy E?
Yeah.
That was a lowrider helicopter.
Yeah. I was big, too, back then, man.
You were big now.
Oh.
No, when we put you in the back of the helicopter there, it was great. It was like putting cinder blocks in the back of a lowrider, a lowered Impala from 64. It really just hugs the ground. And those kinds of aircraft are really difficult to balance. It's like balancing up on top of a great big wooden ball, okay? And with your kind of weight in the back there, the landings were just nice and cushy and smooth like that.
I was checking you out when you was landing there. You'd call it, come on, B, let's get in here. You know, you just landed it like, I'm in control.
Well, you got to talk to it. You talk to it like a horse.
Yeah, you did that.
I do the same thing when I go rock climbing. I talk my way through it there. It's a real good stress relief. You know, it's a really good way to kind of make the energy come out your hands there, because you have to become one with the aircraft. And you remember that we were flying over water a large amount of time there. And I've graduated from a single engine, a jet turbine. It's actually like a jet aircraft, okay, except the propeller is up on top. It's a jet turbine engine. And I've gone from a single engine aircraft now to a twin engine. These are twin turbo prop jets, okay, like you see flying anywhere else. And my instructor, Paulie, and I flew up to Connecticut to a place called Survival Systems, who works with all of the police, the paramedics, the Coast Guard. They work with all of the variations of the military. We had people from game wardens who fly up and down the West Coast watching the Channel Islands for whale watching and stuff like this, you know, conservationists. We had professional pilots. Some of the guys who fly the corporate jets for Sony were up there. We had a New Jersey state trooper and me. And what we do is most people aren't aware, I'll back up a little bit here, is that when we fly helicopters, most people are not aware that we have a much easier capacity to glide than an airplane, okay? When an airplane starts losing its power, then it loses its edge, and the plummet out of the sky is way quicker than in a helicopter. Frequently, we go up to anywhere from 500 feet to 3,000 feet and literally turn off the engine. And at that point, you start what's called auto rotation, okay? The you flood the air up through the rotor system, just like in a toy, okay, like throwing a glider up with a propeller on the top of it. And as it starts to sink down, the air rushes up through that rotor and spins it that much faster. And we practice auto rotation hundreds and hundreds of times because we're routinely flying over inhabited areas. We're routinely flying over people. You know, whether it's on the beachfront or the city here, as you remember, guys, I took you all around Yankee Stadium. We went out over by Ground Zero. We went around the Statue of Liberty here. And the biggest part of training for helicopter flight is the safety issues. The stick and rudder, that's going to take you a few hundred hours. But learning how to do when the little light goes on is the whole rest of the issue. We frequently will go up to 1,000 feet, which is about the height of the Empire State Building, hover, come to a stop. I call it George Jetson stuff. You go literally straight up and come to a stop, and then you can move forward 3 feet, boop, and come to a stop. You can turn it to the right or the left. It's completely stopped in the air, and we turn off the rotor. You literally turn off the engine, and from that standing start, you'll fall out of the sky and you'll pick up the air in your rotor if you know what you're doing, and you can affect a clean auto-rotative landing. You literally glide to the earth the way gliders do. You've seen these airplanes that are pulled into the sky by a prop plane, yeah, and then they disconnect and they'll float around like a hang glider or whatever. It's the same kinds of principles. Most people are unaware of this.
You can completely land it with the engine off?
Oh, totally. We practice this hundreds and hundreds of times. We also practice what's called 180s, because if you have the wind blowing against your back when you attempt to auto rotate, you're going to have a really bad day, if not a lot of dry cleaning up when you finally make that landing. And we practice for water landings as well. There are floats that run along the struts on the bottom of the aircraft, but you're still going to have to do that engine off float to earth. Okay. When we do 180s, the wind is blowing against your back, okay? We shut off the engine, and then you have to turn the aircraft around, face the nose into the wind, and that's what buffets it. It'll pick the nose up a little bit, and if you play it right, you'll float. You'll glide very gently. Not unusual. I think the world's record for auto-rotative process coming from a standing start is 30,000 feet, okay? A fellow from Eurocopter, which is the kinds of helicopters that we fly, coming out of New Jersey there, Eurocopter. That's what a lot of the police use. That's what a lot of the news cameras, you know, the traffic copters and so forth. When you see the Coast Guard, a lot of times out of 10, it's called a Dolphin, and that is a Eurocopter, okay? These aircraft, we practice bringing it around. You get into that wind, and that's what's going to slow you down. Once you get a little bit good at this kind of a procedure, then your instructor, after a few hundred hours, will simply turn off the engine without telling you. And this happens sometimes, okay? There are 10 million little parts in a helicopter, all of them conspiring against you, depending on what the weather is. And you're going to learn to manage that risk. So we'll be flying around. The wind is at my back. I have to memorize where the wind is coming from at any given time. And the instructor will simply turn off the engine. And you'll get all the bells and whistles and all the klaxons going. And, you know, everything starts whistling and screaming at you. All the things light up. And you have to be able to bring it around around, face it into the wind, a complete 180-degree turn, and then locate the spot that you're going to land at. And we're always, always eyeballing a landing zone, a field, a beachfront, some kind of a parking area, some kind of a piece of an abandoned road or whatever. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, you mentioned that before we took off about knowing where all your landing spots are, and I noticed myself seeing every parking lot and field while we were flying around, just like, makes you think about that stuff.
Oh, routinely. And then the way that we fly rotary around here, I call it the grid. You go, you'll take off and you go up to between, right around 1,000 feet to 1,400 feet. Above that is where other airspace develops, because we're flying in between, LaGuardia and JFK airspace. And then you have Newark Tower over on the other side. Their airspace starts at roughly 1,500 feet. So when you go up into the grid, it sounds like the Matrix, you're at about 1,000 to 1,500 feet. Right around in there, and that's as high as the Empire State Building. As you fly in that, they're not long flights, usually between 15 minutes and a couple of hours. When we go to Boston, for example, for St. Patrick's Day, you guys are going with me?
Oh, yeah.
Because we're going to fly down there. I got my instructor, Paulie, and we got one of the cool aircraft here, one of the cool twin engines and so forth. And that'll take about 2 hours, but it's easy navigation. I call it... Just keep New York on the right. Animal? Yep.
Oh, I was going to wonder if you're going to do some of those maneuvers with us. You're going to shut the engine off and let us glide down, man? I want to try with you, dog, you know? Hey, Brian, I got to ask you, too, because you're going to be in there. So you cool with
that? I'm good. Whatever Dave wants to do.
Hey, whatever you want to do, man. We'll glide down with you, man. Just do it.
Okay. We can do that, actually.
I was just kidding, though, man. You know?
I'm catching a train.
Seriously, yeah, you can do it. It's a self-rescue procedure, okay? All helicopter pilots spent hundreds and hundreds of hours practicing this, because you can float. And if you're coming out of the sky, say, at 3,000 feet, you may make it a full mile before you actually have to put it down. And you can land it so gently that frequently, and I got real good at this, that frequently my instructor would put an open cup of coffee on the floorboards right between us, and I could land that sucker without spilling a single drop. Really.
That's why we can trust flying with
it. And we would go again and again until the coffee was freezing cold. Like this. And without spilling a single drop, okay? So this last week what we did to complement this kind of training is we went up to what's called Survival Systems. This is a company that works with all of the military, the police, pilots, whether you're a jet pilot, aircraft, propeller-driven, or hang gliding, whatever. And if you're going to be landing in water, then you have to practice what's called ditching. You know, ditch the aircraft, all right? And this was one of the most fascinating things I've ever done here, is they have a fuselage from an aircraft suspended over a big swimming pool that's almost 20 feet deep, okay? And that aircraft fuselage can be reconfigured to simulate whatever it is you're driving. They'll change the doors, they'll change the seating, they'll change the controls for you, so it's absolute simulation of whatever it is you're flying. If you're a jet pilot, then you have a yoke instead of a stick. You know, if you're a helicopter pilot, you've got that collective on the left, you know, the up and down lever, you know, like this. And the doors are all different depending on what the aircraft is. The faster the aircraft, smaller the door is going to be. Okay. And in front of a turboprop helicopter, a turbojet helicopter, it's a real tight squeeze, and there's no ejection button. Okay. And what you do is you get there's a long briefing session for half the day, and then you get into the aircraft. And you buckle in, four-point harness, just like using what you call it, NASCAR, okay? Just as you would in your aircraft. And they suspend you about 4 or 5 feet over the pool. You buckle in, and they take turns dropping you to the bottom of the pool. I thought, I'm a pretty good swimmer, okay? I figure, come on, I grew up around water. I learned to swim in the ocean outside of Swampscott, Massachusetts, for Christ's sake. Come on, this is going to be an easy. I'm a water man. I taught Animal how to swim, right?
Sure did.
Wrong. This was the most terrifying experience that I've ever had involved of aviation, because when the fuselage hits the water, it floods the entire, all the way up to the ceiling, in about 3 seconds. And you have to wait until that water is touching your chin. It's like the business end of the movie Titanic, but for real, because you're dropping to the bottom of the pool. Your first drop will be in the fuselage as it hits the water and sinks straight down to the bottom. suddenly the light's gone. You can't see anything, okay? You have to disengage the door, find your way out of the harness, get your hands outside of the door, and pull yourself free. That's first stage. It may take you a few tries before you get used to that, because watching that water fold in from the floor and from the seams of the doors is a scary routine. And they have different divers who are there with scuba tanks at the bottom of the pool, you know, preparatory for any problems down there. But you're in an aircraft fuselage, all right? And your mind goes into super overdrive, you know, as far as it's every movie that you've ever seen, every submarine movie, every aircraft movie, every battleship movie that you've ever seen. And that water floods up like that quick. If you botch the breath, you are freaked. Man, you will never forget it in your life. First drop goes straight to the bottom, okay? Disengage one door, swim to the surface. Animal, you got a question. Go ahead.
Yes, my question was, how cold was the water? Because I remember when you was teaching me to swim, you sent me down there by myself to get ready, and I was noticing the water was very cold. And I said, well, your heater broke? And you was like, no. Because when you jump in the falling cold water, it's a whole different thing. You know, you got to not panic and stuff. And I was like, whoa, this is something new. I didn't know that and stuff.
You bet. Good point. Is that the water they keep there is just reaching the comfort level. They could turn it up to 89 degrees or whatever, but just to make sure everybody stays awake, and you know, and after about an hour in that water, everybody's starting to get a little bit of the clench, you know, a little bit of the grip there. Keeps you real, real awake. You don't want anybody getting calm and falling asleep in there. Second stage of all of this gear is you go outside and you jump into the 50 degree ocean off of the pier in a sled that they have out of there. You think you're tough as your toughest customer? Do the 20-foot drop in 50-degree moving seawater. It's only 100 meters outside the door there. I didn't have it in me. Oh, no. My little Elvis was so small. I'm telling you, I didn't have sex for 3 days after that. just from that fear element. Second drop doesn't go straight down. You tie in, you buckle in, four-point harness, and they drop you in and turn you upside down. The fuselage has a huge metal ring that runs around the middle of it like a cigar band, like a band on a cigar in the middle of the cigar. Think of the front half of an airplane. And there's a huge metal ring, like a big wedding ring around it. And the wire fits into the ring, so you can literally turn it upside down as you sink 20 feet to the bottom of the pool. And at that point, they'll shut off the lights. The pool is dark, and you'll discover that you can't get out the door you thought you were leaving. Now you have to motivate to the other side of the fuselage, upside down. Find which way your bubbles are going. You'll feel them perhaps in your helmet that you're wearing, because your helmet will go a little bit light if you're using an oxygen mask. You'll feel it start to pull up off of your nose. If you're wearing glasses, your glasses will float to the top. Your shirt, if your shirt tails are out, they'll start to float up towards wherever. If there's bubbles coming out of your pants, and believe me, a lot of bubbles will be coming out of your pants when you drop upside down into a dark 20-foot pool in a strange aircraft like this. That's the second drop. Third drop, they fall down, goes in straight down, starts to invert, lands on the wing. Now you have to find which door is going to operate open and then save your buddy. Okay? And we went through, we were there for probably 16 hours doing that on Tuesday. So, you know, big shout out to everybody from the Survival Systems Gang and everything up there in Groton, Connecticut. At any rate, ditching!
Roth Radio, a primera hora, televisión Dave, solamente, yeah.
Roth Radio, live in front of your naked steaming eyes, and I have another very special Oscar Week guest here. Her name is Sebelia Vargas. Get her on the phone right here. Sebelia, are you there? It's David Lee.
I'm right here.
Welcome. Did you wake up or stay up for this?
I stayed
Outstanding. And did you go to all the parties last night? Are you calling from Los Angeles, Sibelia?
Yes, I am. I went to a few, but I'll be honest with you. I was just tired as heck.
You were tired.
I had to come back into the office and do all this research and, you know, just get ready for live shots all day today.
Well, that's showbiz. Tell me, what kind of name is Sibelia Vargas?
Yes,
what a great name.
Sibelia Vargas. Well, it's actually of Greek origin. I wish I had known that growing up because my mom decided to name me, and of course I'm in school, you know, and they're going down roll call, and I'm the last because its last name is Vargas, so I'm all the way down at the V's, and my heart's pounding because I know that, you know, everybody's Amy and Pam and all these wonderful names, all American names, and there comes my name.
Yeah,
and
but you guys,
I know the teacher's going to butcher it.
But you guys are now the heroes. You're bigger heroes and more familiar faces and names than half of the characters who are in these movies here. How far would you have gotten if your name was Edna?
I don't know. Sometimes I wish it were so.
How far would Reese Witherspoon get if her name was Edna? Edna Jones. I'm serious. This is important marketing. So tell me, who had the best clothes last night? Which woman had the best clothes?
I would say Michelle Williams. That's Heath Ledger's the mother of his child. She just looks stunning in this beautiful yellow kind of vintage outfit. I mean, you know, we had seen her a couple of times. She was up for supporting actress.
Well, this is the fella from Brokeback Mountain, right?
Right.
So she's got a lot to make up for.
Right.
There's a lot of
keep them interested, you know.
There's a lot of backstage innuendo going around about that cast.
Exactly. She did look absolutely stunning, though. I mean,
she's making more than a single statement, I think, huh? And what do you think about characters like Isaac Mizrahi, who has a really good time on the red carpet with guests like this?
Yeah. No comment. You mean the Scarlett Johansson incident?
Oh, well, I'm talking about his general levity, his general sense of humor, which is great. Do you feel that most of the artists involved have that same sense of humor, or would they prefer that it be a very solemn kind of an occasion?
No, I think they had sense of humor last night. You know, of course, there was a lot of, like, political films and, you know, controversy, but they tried to have fun last night. I don't know how that's going to be reflected in the ratings, because what I'm hearing now from a lot of people, it was that it was kind of boring, the show.
Why do you think that they would say that, Sibelia?
You know, again, I think it probably was, a lot of people had been thinking that there was a Hollywood disconnect with the films that were out, Brokeback Mountain, Crash, Capote, Good Night and Good Luck. These are films that, you know, were just critically acclaimed, but haven't really done that well at the box office.
Then why do you think they wound up being selected for awards?
You know, from what we heard, I mean, all the industry insiders that I've spoken to, they said, you know, Hollywood first was reflecting some of the things that were going on in society, and they decided to go not for box office, they decided to go for the best movies, and those were the best movies.
I'm sorry, I almost interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's what they went for. I mean, they weren't going to have, well, even though The 40-Year-Old Virgin was a good movie, you're not going to just award something just because it's funny or if it's cute or if it does very well at the box office or it makes a lot of money. Hollywood is not into awarding those, and these were the movies that they deemed the best.
I think you have a lot of people my age, and I'm 51, who grew up with film in the 60s and 70s, who are very supportive of the independent movement of left of center writing and acting, and now that we're in charge of the industry, that you're starting to see the response of that. George Clooney is a part and parcel of that. Agree or disagree?
I would agree, and it's very interesting, you know, what's happened with George Clooney and how he's kind of, like, his career has progressed.
Wow, where'd he come from, huh?
Exactly. You know, I mean, he was doing Facts of Life and ER, and all of a sudden he's directing and he's writing Good Night and Good Luck. I mean, such an incredible film, and the content, you know, who would have thunk it, you know? So it's good. Yeah, he's doing very well. He was nominated for three he got three nominations. He kind of broke a record. I mean, he made history. He was nominated for A Good Night and Good Luck, directing it, and also as a supporting actor in Syriana, which he actually ended up getting last night. It was kind of funny when he had his acceptance speech. He was like, okay, I guess since I won the supporting actor award, I guess I'm not taking the director award, you know? And it was like kind of funny.
So what happens? Do you find that more often we're selecting people because of seniority? Did Reese Witherspoon finally get it because she's been at the game for a while, or is this based just purely on one performance, one movie?
I think it's based on one performance, one movie. I mean, you could say, you know, you could, they could have given them the award to Judi Dench, and Judi Dench has been around for quite some time. She's quite an accomplished actress. I mean, the fact that they went with Reese Witherspoon, she's not the youngest in that category. That's Keira Knightley. But, you know, she's definitely young. And if you look at the body of work that she's done, Legally Blonde, Election, Sweet Home Alabama, while they did very well at the box office...
it's all kind of movie light.
It's very movie light. So for her to come out and do this film and do such a stellar job, I think they went on performance because, you know, one would argue that with her body of work, you know, she's not in the same category as Judi Dench.
Not much of a body there, huh?
Okay. Yeah.
So what about when we're talking about surprises that show up in the movies? What stuck out to you as the most surprising moment in a given movie this season?
Well, Brokeback Mountain kind of surprised everyone, I think.
Why, in its popularity or because of the actual content of the movie?
I think both, but I think the fact that it was so controversial that, you know, it came out and all of a sudden, whoa, everyone was talking about it, and it just conjured up all this controversy, and it was just outrageous and over the top. And the fact that they started, during the marketing, they started rolling it out kind of slowly to different markets. They didn't just say, okay, you know, this is a controversial film, let's just go at it, let's just open it in 3,000 movie chains or 3,000 movie theaters. They decided to, you know, strategically open it slowly. Okay. Nobody knew how that was going to do.
Yes, they did. Ang Lee, the major point in your words there is strategic. I don't believe for a second that there was anything out of line or unplanned here. He understands the American mind as well or better than anybody. he was the one who did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, correct? Well, you know, there's also an old saying in Hollywood that nobody can write a comedy for a black sitcom better than a Jewish guy. Now we can expand it to say nobody understands the American way of thinking and our capacity for controversy better than Ang Lee. You agree or disagree?
I think you might be right. I mean, it's just he's a phenomenon, really. I mean, his body of work and the variety of things that he does, he just goes into it and he kind of understands. I mean, he's just got that, I don't know, that international savvy or that wit.
There you go. We're talking to Sibella Vargas, and she is the entertainment correspondent for CNN. Sibella, what is more difficult, creating a role from scratch or doing a biopic?
I don't know. I'm not an actress.
What do you think?
However, I think I would venture to say a biopic. I mean, when you've got to imagine that the pressure is just huge when you're playing somebody. I mean, you can start fresh and you could create a character if it's not a biopic, you know, if it's just a character that's just been made. But when you're playing a true life character, I would imagine that, you know, you want to play it the best that you can. You want to be true to the character. You need to do a lot of research. You have to all of a sudden become that person. And, you know, I mean, you know, Joaquin Phoenix did an amazing job as Johnny Cash, but of course Philip Seymour Hoffman took it for Capote, and my gosh, what a stellar job he did. I mean, everything about him, his voice, his posture, I mean, he had the man down, you know?
That's interesting, because I'm wondering if that's acting or imitation.
I don't know. Well, he had me.
Okay.
He had a lot of people, apparently.
So is It's Hard Out There for a Pimp? That's your favorite song, Sibella?
Well, you know what? I actually like that song.
Sing it to me.
I was surprised for it to kind of...
No problem. Sing it to me.
You know it's hard out there.
Yes!
I can't go any further.
I thought I nailed you there. What was the reaction?
I don't want to get into trouble.
what was the action in the audience when this song was going on? Was everybody well into it, or was it out of character?
I think everybody loved it. I think it was so refreshing. I mean, that was about as urban as it got. You know, it was sort of like so conservative and, you know, the broadcast, and it was you know, like I said, some people thought it was boring, and all of a sudden it was out of nowhere, you know, they're singing this song, and, you know, they had to kind of censor it a little bit because there were some words that, you know.
Of course they do, of course. That, yeah. The ornaments come with the Christmas tree these days. But you know what? That song sounded like early 70s blaxploitation music to me, which I thought was perfectly appropriate for the proceedings. No, really, it sounded like something from Black Caesar or Shaft or one of these kinds of pictures here. At any rate, Sevilla, thank you so much for giving us a call. Have yourself a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
Sevilla Vargas, coming from the entertainment correspondent for CNN. Give me the music one time.